This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back in time to revisit some audacious crimes committed by women trying to make it in a world made for men. These are women who stepped outside their ordinary lives to do extraordinary things. What might their crimes and the times they lived in teach us about women's lives today? Now, we've all seen those scams on the internet which say, "Give me your money and I'll tell you the secret formula to my success." Well, today I'm investigating a very similar hoax. It was pulled off by an obscure young painter called Anne Mary Provis. She was the daughter of a minor royal servant in Georgian London who mesmerised some of the most respected painters of her day and had them eating out of her hand. And I'm asking, do we sometimes believe things just because we want them to be true? It's May 1797. The newspapers and fashionable London society are in a state of high excitement, anticipating the opening of the annual exhibition at the Royal Academy of Arts. But when the exhibition opens, it's clear that something's gone badly wrong, with pictures done by some of London's most famous artists, including the president of the Royal Academy himself.
"The colouring of this picture is so irreconcilable. It appears to us as if all the parties from heaven and hell had been soused over head and ears in the juice of pickled cabbage."
"For some very extraordinary reason, he's given one of the characters green hair."
"Had any mother an infant thus covered with hues of crimson and yellow, would she not assume the consequences of a scarlet fever?"
So why are these pictures such a disaster? What kind of trick is being played on these august gentlemen? To find out more, I went to the Royal Academy of Arts in central London. I'm in the very grand courtyard of Burlington House, just off Piccadilly. Now, in the 18th century, members of the Royal Academy, and other leading artists too, were obsessed with the idea of rediscovering the secrets of the Venetian masters of the Renaissance, especially Titian. Titian was a kind of godlike figure for them. How did Titian achieve his intense, luminous colours? Could his recipe, if you like, be recreated? So, when a young artist and her father come along, claiming that they have access to the lost recipe, the Venetian secret, as it comes to be known, they find a very receptive audience. To help me explore the story of Anne Mary Provis, that young artist, I'm delighted to be joined by the current president of the Royal Academy of Arts, the painter and printmaker, Rebecca Salter. Hello, Rebecca, and welcome to Lady Swindlers.
Well, hello, Lucy, and welcome to the Royal Academy.
Thank you. Can you tell me exactly what the Royal Academy is?
Well, it was founded in 1768 by a group of artists and architects. They immediately then founded the Royal Academy Schools, and it became a very simple mechanism, in a way, for the transfer of knowledge from one generation of artists to the next, and that continues to this day.
Rebecca, you're the first woman to be president of the Royal Academy. Why has it taken 250 years?
Well, these things take time. And in fact, I think I'm only the 28th president. So
really?
Yeah. Yeah, so here we are.
Got there in the end.
Got there in the end, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I hope not to be the last.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you, Rebecca, some more in a bit. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm now in the library at the Royal Academy of Arts. It's the most fabulous room. It's totally lined with these leather-bound tomes. And I'm with Dr. Jacqueline Riding, an author and specialist in the history and the art of the 18th century. Jackie, welcome to Lady Swindlers.
Thank you.
Now, I've just been talking to Rebecca Salter, the first female president of the Royal Academy in its 250-year history. But, Jackie, there were female artists at the time of the founding of the Academy, weren't there?
There were. There were two female artists in 1768 of the 36 of the founding missions, Mary Moser and Angelica Kaufmann. And we are sitting in front of a very large group portrait showing some, not all, but some of the founding members of the Royal Academy of Art. Angelica Kaufmann and Mary Moser are included in this image as two portraits on the far wall.
Is that something to do with the fact that these gentlemen have got their kit off?
Yes, exactly right. This is a life class. So these guys are drawing these two naked male figures. Now, there's certainly nothing in the rules of the Royal Academy to say that women couldn't attend these life classes. But I think it's just for delicacy's sake they are hanging on the wall.
Interesting. Bit indelicate. OK.
These were highly trained professional women artists, commercial artists, Angelica Kaufmann and Mary Moser. There's been some great recent research by women art historians on how many women were actually commercial artists in this period, and particularly who was exhibiting at the Royal Academy from 1769 right the way through to 1830. There are hundreds of women, but they are not becoming academicians. But it's still bewildering that there wasn't a woman elected until, 1930s, Dame Laura Knight.
Gosh. Now, we're interested in the story of this young female artist called Anne Mary Provis. What do we know about her?
Not much. Well, we do know that Thomas, her father, was what's lovingly called a sweeper, connected to the royal household, the Chapel Royal at St James's. It might be a bit lowly, the very idea of being a caretaker, but it was regular money, so presumably that was keeping body and soul together. And that may well have helped her pay for some training. She may well have been a miniature painter. And if it is the same Provis, then she actually submitted and had accepted a miniature of a portrait of a child in 1787.
So she hung in the Academy.
So she did have, if it's the same woman, she did have a piece of art in the Royal Academy. That, and if she is a miniature painter, then of course she's got that. It's on a small scale, which was very popular amongst women. You know, that's a sort of domestic size art.
What sort of other career paths might be available to female artists at the time?
Well, you could be portrait painters, you could be copyists, you could be working in the print trade. There was a roaring print trade with women running print businesses. Women are active in the art world, and I think we're only really starting to learn about this through this brilliant scholarship, dare I say, predominantly by women art historians.
You're making the 18th century art world sound like it's got a surprising amount of female activity contained within it, then.
Yes, well, yes, exactly right. I mean, when art history was first starting to literally unearth and uncover women artists, the big question was asked, you know, why haven't there been any old mistresses? Where are the great women painters? I mean, they're just hiding in plain sight and somebody's bothering to look.
Rebecca Salter, our guest detective, has joined me in the studio to talk further about this story. Rebecca, Jackie was talking just now about the opportunities for female artists in the 18th century. When you were starting out back in the day, did you feel that there was an equal playing field?
Almost certainly not. When I was at art school, there was no regular member of staff who's a woman who taught me. And I don't remember women artists in history of art lectures. So, I mean, it's often said now, if you can't see it, you can't be it, is the expression about role models. But the truth is, there was no female role model when I was at art school.
As the first female president of the Royal Academy, Rebecca, obviously people are looking to you as a role model. Do you feel the pressure of that gaze?
I think there is a pressure for any woman who is the first woman to do a job, because, of course, if you do it badly, it's usually put down to the fact that you're a woman rather than you might actually not be very good at the job. So there is extra pressure. And also, I don't want to be the last, so I've got to kind of be reasonably good at it.
You're not only letting yourself down, you're letting the whole gender down.
Yeah.
Now, Anne-Mary Provis is an elusive figure, and sadly we don't really have her side of the story. We don't get to hear her voice ever. But we do have a vital source in the diary of Joseph Farrington. He was a painter and a member of the Royal Academy. He is rather fond of himself, is Mr. Farrington. He's very ambitious. He sees himself as a bit of a power player. Farrington has heard rumours that the Provises, dad and daughter, have inside knowledge of this lost secret of the Venetian masters. So he invites them to tea to hear what they have to say.
Mr. Provis began the account of his discovery. It was from papers of his grandfather, who was in Italy, and who related that at Venice the account of the process of Titian and the great masters was communicated to him by his friend Signor Bari.
The Provises claim that this Italian manuscript was lost in a house fire, so they can't show it to Farrington. Although they say that they'd made a transcript of the most important bits, not that they're showing him this either. Farrington records in his diary the sad story of Anne Mary's early life. She was born in 1770. Her mother died when she was three, and then she was looked after by her grandmother until she died too.
Her father proposed that she should be bred to maintain herself by her needle, but a passion for drawing and painting prevailed over every other inclination, and Provis allowed her to indulge it. During several years, she devoted her time to this pursuit. Over-application affected her health and spirits. Her disposition is very amiable, and she is of religious turn.
Now, Rebecca, the Provises have clearly made a favourable impression on Farrington. But it's quite interesting the way Anne Mary comes across. It's a heavily gendered description of her, I feel. She's religious, she's amiable. The implication is she's weak. If she tries too hard at anything, she becomes mentally deranged.
Yes, clearly they'd have been far happier if she'd taken up
the needlework.
Suggested needlework,
yes.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so she's going off in the wrong direction, as they were concerned.
Yeah. Is it true that everybody who becomes an artist probably does it in defiance of good advice from elder people in their lives?
Well, it could. I mean, I was told at school that I would never get into art school.
Well, you're living embodiment
of
this then.
Yes.
Interesting. Let's find out what happens next. Farrington goes on to describe how Miss Provis has been introduced to Benjamin West, the president of the Royal Academy, by another artist 2 years before, and that she has been demonstrating the secret to him ever since. But West hasn't signed an agreement with the Provises or anything like that, and he hasn't given them any money either for the secret. He's not even paying Anne-Mary for her assistance in his studio, let alone giving her any credit for her work. After months of prevarication from West and no money, the Provises are getting a bit fed up with him. West is rumoured to have several paintings lined up for the 1797 exhibition using the Venetian secret. And this makes Farrington and his friends even more desperate to know what West and Miss Provis have been up to. They start thinking about how they might do West over and buy the secret from the Provises for themselves. Rebecca, are there things that you've experienced where you thought, oh, I wish I knew how they did that?
Yes. I mean, I think there is a tremendous obsession with making at the moment. And I think people are very keen to attend sort of masterclasses.
Mm.
How does it happen? What are the secrets of making it work?
So I think we can possibly imagine the hunger of these artists to want to know how to do their own work better, which is admirable, isn't it?
But I think it's very interesting that they took her seriously, you know, as a woman coming along with these enticing secrets. It's very interesting that she got as far as she did.
Yes, why didn't they immediately think here's a charlatan?
Here's this little, you know, what would she know?
Mm. But she's got some status, hasn't she? Because obviously Benjamin West thinks that she's worth talking to and spending time
exactly.
with.
Exactly, exactly. So she had the sort of presidential stamp of approval.
Yeah, yeah. So back to the story. On the night of January the 12th, 1797, Anne Mary and her father meet Farrington and six other Royal Academicians at Wright's Coffee House on the Charing Cross Road, and they sign an agreement. The Provises will not show the artists their transcript of the supposedly burned Italian manuscript, But if they each pay 10 guineas, Aunt Mary will demonstrate the technique to them. The idea is that once they've had exclusive access for a while, the Provosis can then release the secret to 53 other artists and make a total of 600 guineas. Now, that's enough money to buy a nice annuity for Anne Mary. It would give her financial security for the rest of her life. Now, I can only imagine how nervous Anne Mary must have been when she woke up on the 30th of January, 1797, because this was the day that she has to go to Farrington's studio to begin demonstrating the secret to the seven people who signed up and paid.
She began the Venetian process by beginning to paint a head with white only on a dark ground. She also glazed with colours a head she had prepared with white. Myself and others are convinced that it is a discovery of great importance.
Throughout February, Anne Mary visits the seven artists, demonstrating the secret bit by bit. This is quite clever. She only shows them a little bit at a time, making them want more. Now, her father may say that she's fragile, but I'm pretty impressed by Anne Mary, because it must be really hard to paint in front of other people, right? Is there a lot of pressure there?
Very hard, but I think it's very interesting that they used people's perceptions of women as potentially weak as a sort of weapon to maintain their position. I thought it was quite clever of her father.
Now, Rebecca, these artists who have coughed up the money for The Secret, they are the elite, right? They're top of their profession, which makes it seem like they're kind of doubly foolish to me.
But maybe if you are so confident in your own position as they would have been, maybe they just didn't question it.
The fact that there's seven of them all together as well.
Well, that's, yes, a strength in numbers.
Yeah, nobody wanted to.
And also
to step
you
up.
Wouldn't want to be the first one who said, look, you know, this looks a bit fishy to me.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's April 1797, and Benjamin West and the Royal Academicians who signed up with the Provises are now hanging their pictures, painted in accordance with The Secret, for the annual exhibition. West has painted four pictures with the new process, the most prominent being his big history painting called Cicero Discovering the Tomb of Archimedes. Now, the fact that The Secret exists has got out there. Anticipation is huge. Massive numbers of visitors come to see these paintings in this exhibition. But oh dear! When the exhibition opens, the reaction is terrible. The paintings, they're hugely disappointing. They're disliked by the public and they are savaged by the press.
Instead of possessing Titian's warmth divine, they are nothing but the chalky and cold tints of fresco.
For some very extraordinary reason, he's given one of the characters green hair.
If Mr. West would now and then look at his former works, we think he would blush at his present incorrect manner.
It's becoming all too obvious that these eminent artists have fallen for a hoax. There was no Venetian secret. They've been taken for fools by a scheming servant and his clever young daughter. Back at the Royal Academy, I wanted to find out from Jackie Riding how the story plays out.
We're back in the library at the Royal Academy, and Jackie and I are looking at a reproduction of the picture that caused the most outrage from the critics, by Benjamin West, at this exhibition. So what we're looking at is Cicero discovering the tomb of Archimedes, and we've got a group of gentlemen in a really rather lovely classical landscape. There's a volcano going off in the background. Jackie, what is it that they didn't like?
This painting, no matter how good or bad or indifferent it was supposed to be displaying this technique in action.
Mm.
This rediscovered Venetian style of painting brought into the sort of late 18th century by the venerable president of the Royal Academy.
So expectation was pretty high.
I'd say it was about as high as any expectation could ever possibly be. And of course it was going to fall down because The Secret didn't exist. It's all rubbish. You know, he has, you know, been a dupe. And I wonder how much he was starting to realise that he really had been duped. Benjamin West is sort of setting himself up to fail because Titian, you know, there's nothing that beats great technique. You know, Titian's a great technician, he's a great artist. I'm afraid Benjamin West just isn't. Doesn't matter any amount of magic potions and so-called secrets divulged is going to make him a better artist. And I think he deserved everything he got.
Well, Benjamin West, people have turned against him, right?
Yeah.
What sort of blowback does he now experience?
Well, he gets the worst type of blowback because he gets James Gilray on the case, the great late 18th century satirist.
Gilray. This is a killer Gilray satirical cartoon about the whole affair, is it?
So it is very complicated, but the key elements of it is that you have a rainbow that cuts through the middle of the coloured engraving. Standing on that rainbow is our heroine, Anne Mary Provis.
Oh, yes, there she is. She looks rather fabulous. Her hair is blowing in the wind. She's got some naked ladies holding her train for her, which is made out of peacock feathers. Look at her high-heeled red shoes. Who is she painting a portrait of? Who's that old man?
Well, that's Titian.
That's Titian. She's communing with Titian. She's bringing Titian to life with her own paintbrush.
There she is. She's in the middle of this entire engraving. We know very little bit about her artist training, and yet there she is. She's got a palette, she's got brushes, she's got the oils all separated out onto her palette, and she is the artist in the middle of this scene. And then below her, you've got the assembled Royal Academicians, and the most prominent are the gang that are still giddy enough to think that this process actually exists and is worth trying out.
Is that Benjamin West skulking off into the corner?
He's in the shadows and sort of skulking off.
Oh, he's completely shamed, isn't he?
And leaving the rest behind.
He's departing the field, vanquished.
Exactly. But he's the one who convinced the others to join the scam. Mm. And yet in this image, he's skulking off like some thief in the night.
So in this image, Anne Mary is clearly in charge of everything. She's the focus of attention. These artists are all in her thrall. What happens to her next? Does any of her art survive?
Some of her work may survive. We've got to find it, because I think she's an interesting enough example of a woman potentially exhibiting at the Royal Academy before any of this had been dreamt up. Well, this is why this is so precious, because, you know, in order to convince Royal Academicians that this technique has any semblance of truth about it, you would have to be reasonably proficient. You'd have to be able to paint. She had to be convincing. And I think she's interesting enough to dig a bit deeper and find out a bit more about her.
So, after all that, what was Anne Mary's Venetian secret? Well, it was nothing more than an exaggerated way of applying existing techniques. A dark red background with lots of white painted on top, then thin layers of glazes on top of that. But the real giveaway is the prominence in her technique of a pigment called Prussian blue, which wasn't invented until 1706. So it wasn't even invented until 200 years after Titian was painting. Anne Mary's immortalised not just by Gilray in his satire, but also in a widely circulated popular song written by another artist called Paul Sandby. So the song goes like this. It is, it's a little bit funny, but it's really very icky too. Miss brought her titbit first to West, a president to all the rest. He to the bottom groped it best. Well, I'm pleased that they're having a pop at Mr. West for his gullibility, but I'm sorry it's been made to sound like Anne Mary's had her bottom groped as well. The song goes on to name all the artists who were hoaxed, each in turn having their way, as the song puts it, with Miss Provis. Each verse is full of crude sexual puns, which imply that her visits to the artist studios weren't actually much to do with painting. It's pretty depressing, isn't it, Rebecca? Really undignified and sexualizing, isn't it? Because she's just being presented as a sexual object, I suppose. They're not even taking her seriously as a swindler.
Yes, and I think, sadly, I mean, when I was at art school, there was still the feeling that, you know, the male tutors could
prey on the female students.
Prey on the female students, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So it's been going on for a while.
Now, there were just two women of the 36 artists who founded the Royal Academy in 1768. Today, there are roughly 100 Royal Academicians at any given time. Is that right?
Well, if you look at the academicians under 75, we're now at 43% women. So over the last 10 years, 59% of the new Royal Academicians elected have been women.
How far do you think we have to go before women entering into the art world, beginning their careers, will be able to do that in conditions of true equality? What's left to be done?
I think there are still some interesting anomalies. More than 50% of the graduates of art schools are women. But I think if you look at the numbers of women showing in galleries, is still not 50%. Then again, if you look at auction prices for works by women, still not 50-50 and unlikely to reach that, frankly, for a while. So there's still work to do. I mean, there's no doubt things are getting better, but there's still a way to go.
So the art we have reflects the society that we are.
Yeah. And it reflects a long history of not being equal. So there's a lot of ground to make up.
Fascinating. It's interesting that Anne-Marie and her father seem to have avoided any punishment for their rather ingenious hoax. There's no record that they were ever prosecuted. And I imagine it was perhaps too embarrassing for the academicians to have it all dragged through the courts and the newspapers. We do get one more glimpse of Anne-Marie in history, though, as the sole beneficiary of her father's will. She was described as his dear and beloved daughter when he dies in 1821. At that point, she still has the surname Provis. She was 51 then, so she's probably unmarried. And after that, she disappears from history. Now, Rebecca, what do you take away from this whole story of Anne-Marie? What do you think she might have actually been like?
Quite like to sit down and have a cup of coffee with her, I think, because I think she's got a very strong sense of her own ability and her own identity. I mean, society may have been difficult for women artists, but I think there was a very strong feeling that they were just as good as the men, if only they had the chance.
Now, Anne-Marie Provis is an elusive figure. Oh, I so wish we could hear her side of the story rather than hearing it only from the men involved. But it is clear that she's a swindler with real panache, very cool with the paintbrush under pressure. And despite the best efforts of a competitive, snobbish, cliquey group of men, she makes fools of them all. At first, this seemed to be a story about a lost artistic technique. But I've come to think it's really a story about a lost artist. Somebody who was probably exhibited herself in the Royal Academy and someone who was good enough for the artistic elite to take seriously. It is possible that none of Anne-Marie's paintings survive, but I'm very glad, though, that at least the story of her amazing swindle does, because it's a warning to us all, a cautionary tale. Don't believe something just because you want it to be true. Well, a huge thank you to Rebecca Salter and her colleagues at the Royal Academy and to Dr. Jacqueline Riding. Next time on Lady Swindlers, we're joined by Baroness Ayesha Hazarika to discuss a beauty scammer, a career criminal, and an uncommon thief. And we're going to ask, does crime pay? Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.